Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host and producer, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. I have a doctorate in public law and American politics from Claremont Colleges and a bachelor's degree from Wayland Baptist University in Hawaii. Hawaii. So excited that Alan Beck, our guest that came on the podcast last year, about a year ago, spring of 2024, has just won last week at the Ninth Circuit, a case involving registration of firearms in Hawaii, a law that I myself was subjected to. And it's so exciting to see Alan Beck succeeding. And to see the work of Chuck Michel, also a guest on this podcast, succeeding. The work of Stephen Holbrook, also a guest on this podcast, succeeding. The work of so many others that are too numerous to name. We are so grateful for all the work that has been done in the Second Amendment space. Nice job, guys. Nice job. We're going to continue today on Chevron deference with Loper Bright. You guys know that Loper Bright overruled Chevron last year. We're going to start with the dissent in Loper Bright because that will be easier for your mind to follow. The dissent defends Chevron deference from being overruled. And so it's a nice segue right from what we did last episode, which was the very end of Stevens' opinion in 1984, the one he wrote for the court in the Chevron case. This dissent is written by Justice Kagan, and she's a Democrat. It was published June 28th, 2024, with whom Sotomayor and Justice Jackson join. So the Democrats are all in lockstep for upholding Chevron. And the Republicans on the Supreme Court are all on the other side overruling it. I want you to keep that in mind as we go through this. What explains this shift? Now, of course, you have the reasoning here. I'm asking you to listen carefully to the reasoning given in the argument and also read between the lines a little bit, see what you can see. Don't ignore the argument, listen to the argument. But what has developed since Chevron that would cause the concern for Republicans on the court, and what conversely has the Democrats totally freaked out that Chevron is overruled? Remember, this has to do with the administrative state. Okay, so here we go. Ready? For 40 years. Let me guess, you want to see it. Okay, I'll share my screen. Hold on. All right, I'm back. Go to Giggle Scholar. Oh, sorry, Google Scholar. I get those two confused. Go to case law. Go to federal courts. Go to Loper Bright. Okay. Now, you're going to want the Supreme Court one from 2024. Here it is. How fun. Now we're going to hit the dissent first. So I like to search dissenting. And of course, we have lots of uses of the term dissenting. Finally, we're here. And what page is this on? I don't think they have page numbers yet. Well, actually, they do. Now you can find this in a slip opinion, what's called a slip opinion. Should I show you that? Yeah, I'll show you. Loper Bright. Oh, there we go. I just had it. Loper Bright. The Supreme Court publishes what they call slip opinions when the book itself is not out yet. So here's, it's called a slip opinion. You see that? And it's numbered differently. You got one, two. I'm scrolling down the PDF, three, and so on and so forth. Giggle Scholar has what we assume will be the pagination in the volume when it comes out, the bound volume of the Federal Reporter. But of course, those are not available and they're very expensive. And not even some of the best law schools have those bound volumes yet. I guess they're too expensive. I don't know, but I like the bound volumes myself. We go to Giggle Scholar just because, it's what we have. Okay, but you can compare this with the slip opinion if you want to make sure it's the same text. But we haven't had too many problems, if any problems that I know about, in the Federal Reporter since the very early days of our republic, when there were some disagreements about the Federal Reporter. For example, there was a copyright case. I think it was actually the very first copyright case ever before the Supreme Court that involved the Supreme Court reporter. His name was Wheaton. And there was another guy named Cranch. And there were like the earliest ones were named after, they were actually just people and they published them under their names, but they were the Federal Reporter for the Supreme Court. And it took a long time for them to publish Supreme Court decisions, opinions. And well, anyway, this guy Wheaton had made some money actually selling Supreme Court decisions. And another guy kind of took over, and I think another guy took over as Federal Reporter, and he was making it available for free or something. I can't remember how it worked, but there was a dispute about copyright. And then the Supreme Court, I think it was Justice Joseph Story, said, you can't copyright this stuff. It's in the public domain. So there is no copyright on Supreme Court dis opinions. So we're not, we don't have to say we're making a fair use of this material because it doesn't really matter if we're making a fair use of material. We're not, we don't have to have a transformative reading. We do that. We are making a fair use in a transformative reading, but that's not required by copyright law because it's not copyrighted. It's in the public domain. All right. More than you ever wanted to know, I'm sure, but we kind of nerded out for 40 years. Justice Kagan says Chevron USA Inc. versus Natural Resource Defense Council Inc. 467 U.S. reports at page 837, 1984, has served as a cornerstone of administrative law. Allocating responsibility for statutory construction between courts and agencies under Chevron. Under Chevron. Hey, what's up, sir? Chevron USA. Under Chevron, a court uses all its normal interpretive tools to determine whether Congress has spoken to an issue. If the court finds Congress has done so, that is the end of the matter. The agency's views make no difference. But if the court finds at the end of its interpretive work that. Now remember, guys, I'm reading from the paper. I like the paper. I like doing this. Remember Rush Limbaugh used to do that? You remember that? I like the paper. I like to print it out. Okay. But I know you need Giggle Scholar. You young people, you need Giggle. At the end of its interpretive work, that Congress, hold up, yo, hold up. But if the court finds at the end of its interpretive work that Congress, okay, here we are right here, has left an ambiguity or gap, then a choice must be made. Who should give content to a statute when Congress's instructions have run out? I think that's worth highlighting right here. I think that's worth highlighting. Who? Wow. I mean, I wrote in my margin here, wow. Who? Wow. Who should give content to a statute when Congress's instructions have run out? Did you see that? Are you seeing that? Who should give content to a statute? That's a direct quote from the dissent. Who should give content to a statute? Well, let's see if the Constitution helps us out a little bit. When you're giving content to a statute, that's called a legislative power. Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution suggests that all legislative powers herein granted, and that would be giving content to a statute because that's a product of Congress, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in an administrative state full of bureaucrats with civil service tenure who can't be fired by the president and who are protected by Democrat judges from Donald Trump. Now, I'm just quoting from the Constitution. And I can't believe Donald Trump's name is in the Constitution. I can't believe that. But the founders knew about Donald Trump and they put his name in there and they said, you got to really watch out for this guy because he's going to get you and he's going to make the government less powerful. And you want to really watch out for anybody that is going to be taking a close look at who's really in charge of the executive branch. You got to be careful. And so, therefore, all legislative powers can be given to whoever Kagan wants to give it to. And Kagan's name is in the U.S. Constitution. I don't know if you know that. But yeah, Justice Kagan, she's mentioned. They knew about her and they were like, she is going to save all of us. She's going to save America. That's in the U.S. Constitution. It's amazing. I mean, you would think that was a miracle that the founders knew about Justice Kagan and well, yeah, I am kidding. I am kidding. Let's go back to Loper Bright. Who should give content to a statute? The Constitution itself says who gives content to a statute, but Kagan, she thinks her name is in the Constitution as the savior. Because the founders, those crazy people wanted Congress to do all this stuff. And she knows better because she went to, she went to college. And that's why Queen Elizabeth was so powerful is because I don't know if you know the original Queen Elizabeth, she got her associate's degree and the sky was the limit for her. Man, she became monarch pretty quickly after that. Yeah, I'm in a sarcastic mood today, guys. I'm not going to apologize for it because when you have All Democrats asking who should give content to a statute. I mean, this is the Supreme Court. You would have thought they would have been vetted out by now, like if they didn't know the answer to that question. We're going to continue.
You're just biased, man. You're just biased.
Well, why they pay me the big bucks here. Okay. Who should give content to a statute when Congress's instructions have run out? Should it be a court? I mean, aren't you kind of assuming an answer to that by writing this, Kagan? Should it be the agency Congress has charged with administering the statute? The answer Chevron gives is that it should usually, yeah, it should like usually. The answer Chevron gives, that would be the court, is that it should usually be the agency. That would be the executive branch, for those of you just joining, within the bounds of reasonableness. Now, who put that reasonableness thing in there? Did I see that in the Constitution? If it's reasonable, all legislative power shall be granted. You know, I don't see anything about reasonableness in there. Is it just me? Okay, let's continue. That rule has formed the backdrop against which Congress, courts, and agencies, as well as regulated parties and the public, have operated for decades. It has been applied in thousands of judicial decisions. It has become a part of the warp and woof of modern government. Maybe that's why they're defending it. Maybe that's why the Democrats are defending it. Supporting regulatory efforts of all kinds. I think we have a clue of why the Democrats are defending this. To name a few, keeping air and water clean, food and drugs safe, and financial markets honest. And the rule is right. As a bonus, this court has long understood Chevron deference to reflect what Congress would want, and so to be rooted in a presumption of legislative intent. Congress knows that it does not, and in fact cannot, write perfectly complete regulatory statutes. That's also worth highlighting. Congress knows that it does not, and in fact cannot, write perfectly complete regulatory statutes. Let me ask you a question. I want you to read that sentence again. Congress knows that it does not, and in fact cannot, write perfectly complete regulatory statutes. Okay, well, I have this in my notes on the side. Okay. On the side, I have this note. What follows from this? What follows from that? Congress doesn't do a very good job of creating really complicated laws. Sounds like that's what she's saying. Well, then why does Congress create and is expected to create really complicated laws? Why is that? What in the world could go wrong? It knows that those statutes will inevitably contain ambiguities that some other actor will have to resolve and gaps that some other actor will have to fill. Well, if they're really complicated, yeah. But why are we assuming the government should be doing this? I mean, you just kind of implied that the government can't do really complicated things according to the Constitution and according to what they're capable of. I mean, isn't that what you just said? So, she's kind of saying that we have to kind of ignore the Constitution because some other actor will have to legislate. That's what she's saying. And it would usually prefer that actor to be the responsible agency, not a court. Some interpretive issues arising in the regulatory context involve scientific or technical subject matter. Agencies have expertise in those areas, courts do not. Some demand a detailed understanding of complex and interdependent regulatory programs. Agencies know those programs inside and out, including trade-offs between competing goods. Agencies report to a president. Oh, that's interesting. I think she's assuming that the president can fire people in these agencies. Otherwise, what would happen if they failed to report to the president and they just decided to do whatever the hell they wanted to do, like we've seen with some federal agencies recently? And as we've seen in the past, for example, a topic we're covering on the Republican Professor podcast, Scalia's dissent in Morrison versus Olson. This is within our lifetime, people. It's not like it's a non-issue that's never happened. It's happened. It's happening. It's happening right before your eyes. You have eyes to see. Well, agencies report to a president who in turn answers to the public for his policy calls. Now, how does he answer to the public? This is another thing I want to point out. Who in turn answers to the public? Well, how does he answer to the public? That's a real question I'm asking. I want you to tell me, how does he answer to the public? How does the president answer to the public? He can't be fired by the public unless the public acts through Congress to fire him. You know what I mean, Vern? Unless and until Congress impeaches and removes the president. That's Congress, though. Sure, that can happen. That can happen. I think she means that in the classically understood theory of the executive in American politics, the president answers to the public in elections. But that's a very old understanding because at least after FDR, and in Truman's day, people were so freaked out, including people who voted for FDR. They were so freaked out that they decided to amend the Constitution to prevent the president from getting elected a third time for president. So if you have a president in his second term, how exactly does he answer to the public? He's not running again. The public can't fire him. How does he answer to the public? Agencies report to a president. Okay, but what if they don't report? Can he fire them? The power to remove is the power to control. If you don't have power to remove, how do you control? Courts have no such accountability. Why? Why do you say that? The basis for removal of a president is the same for a court. Can a judge be impeached and removed by this Congress? Yes. Yes. Yeah. In fact, just recently there has been a U.S. congressman who was a federal judge who was impeached and removed by Congress. And he was a congressman. Guess what? Democrat. That's a shocker. I know there's corruption in the Republican Party too, but it's a real shocker when you have these really corrupt cities run entirely by Democrats for a long time. Corrupt states like California run entirely by Democrats for a long time. Washington, D.C. is like 96% Democrat. So, no, I'm not going to say both parties do it because we're not talking about both parties here. Courts have no such accountability and no proper basis for making policy. I think you must be saying something about election then, not impeachment, because judges are subject to impeachment. But a president in his second term is not running again for election. So where's the accountability? I don't see where you're talking about. His term is 4 years. There's nothing that's going to stop that. And of course, go back to Kagan. And of course, Congress has conferred on that expert, experienced, and politically accountable agency. It's only politically accountable if that president can fire people there. The authority to administer, to make rules about and otherwise implement the statute giving rise to the ambiguity, or go to the next page, gap. Pull all that together. Put all that together, and deference to the agency is the almost obvious choice based on an implicit congressional delegation of interpretive authority. Now, I gotta do this again. I gotta do this again. An implicit delegation of interpretive authority. I think the executive branch has an independent, inherent obligation and hence power, because you can't have a duty without the power to interpret the Constitution. I don't think that that's delegated by Congress. I think that's just inherent in the executive power. For example, the president takes care of the laws be faithfully executed. That's a duty of the president. Well, then it follows that the president must have the power to know and to interpret what the laws are so that he can do that. That's not delegated by Congress. That's inherent in the executive power. Yeah, the delegation issue here. Remember, I said this last time. I said pay attention to the delegation issue. Now, here's what's strange is interpretive authority, that sounds almost judicial to me. And it's interesting. Isn't that what the court is doing? They're interpreting statutes, right? And the point of interpreting a statute would be to say what the law is, to quote Marbury versus Madison. We defer. We defer. The court has explained. She's talking about the majority opinion there in Loper Bright. Because of a presumption that Congress would have desired the agency rather than the courts to exercise whatever degree of discretion the statute allows. All right, we're cruising through this at breakneck speed. Today, the court flips the script. It is now the court rather than the agency that will wield power when Congress has left an area of interpretive discretion. A rule of judicial humility gives way to a rule of judicial hubris. Remember, this is Justice Kagan writing for the Democrats in dissent of Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo 144 Supreme Court at page 2244. The Supreme Court. So this is not the U.S. reporter. This is the Supreme Court reporter. Okay. What's the difference? Well, I don't want to get into that. Okay. This will be in the 603rd volume of the U.S. reports. But we don't know the page number. That's in the slip opinion. I'll show you what I mean when you look at the slip opinion. It'll be at the top. Usually says cite as. Where is it? There it is. You see, cite as 603 US, and then we don't know the page number. They'll say the page number when it goes into the US reports. So Giggle Scholar is using the Supreme Court reporter, not the US reporter. Sorry. Sorry for these. I know more than you ever wanted to know. Judicial hubris. Okay. So that's where we're at. Judicial hubris. That's what she's saying. This is judicial hubris. In recent years, this court has too often taken for itself decision-making authority Congress has assigned to agencies. The court has substituted its own judgment on workplace health for that of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, its own judgment on climate change for that of the Environmental Protection Agency, and its own judgment on student loans for that of the Department of Education. But evidently, that was, for this court, all too piecemeal. In one fell swoop, the majority today gives itself exclusive power over every open issue, no matter how expertise driven or policy laden, involving the meaning of regulatory law. Wow. Let's camp out here for a sec. In one fell swoop, the majority today gives itself exclusive power over every open issue, no matter how expertise driven or policy laden, involving the meaning of regulatory law. Let's cut the middle part out here and just see how it reads. The majority today gives itself exclusive power over every open issue involving the meaning of regulatory law. Maybe it's just me, but isn't the court supposed to be an expert on the meaning of law? And isn't regulatory law part of law? How is it that the court is giving itself power here? Isn't it power they already have? And isn't it expertise that they already have in law? Are we suggesting that we give or we allow the meaning of regulatory law, which is a part of law, to be decided by the executive branch? It sounds like that's what she's saying. I mean, look at these examples she just gave. She gave three examples. OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health, that's in the executive branch. I think it's in the U.S. Labor Department. The EPA, that's in the executive branch. And the Department of Education, that's in the executive branch. Is she saying the meaning of regulatory law is to be decided by the executive branch? Sounds like that's what she's saying. And she sounds like she's upset that the Supreme Court has a problem with that. A court whose job it is to say what the law is, according to Marbury versus Madison. I mean, and Marbury versus Madison didn't come up with that. They just articulated it in that quotation pretty clearly. But isn't that what she's trying to do here? Isn't she trying to say as a judge that that's not what the law is? I mean, I think she's trying to imply that regulatory law should be done by the executive branch, and this itself is part of regulatory law, and she knows because she's a federal judge, and take my word for it. It's a little bit ironic. Well, let's keep going. Does your brain hurt yet? Are you falling asleep? Well, let's see here. But evidently, okay, so as if it did not have enough on its plate, the majority turns itself into the country's administrative czar. Well, she just said that she used the term law here. I mean, am I blind here? Tell me if I'm LAW. Is it still spelled that way? LAW, law. And she's saying that this aspect of law that the Supreme Court is weighing in on as a court of law, means that it's pretending to be a czar or something. Now, this is bizarre to me. It defends that move as one suddenly required by the nearly 80-year-old Administrative Procedure Act. But the act makes no such demand. Today's decision is not one Congress directed. It is entirely the majority's choice. You know what's ironic about this? The ironic thing is that she's defending Chevron. And isn't it the case that the court came up with Chevron deference, not Congress? I'm pretty sure that that was the Supreme Court that came up with Chevron, not Congress. Am I smoking crack here, or she's complaining about the position of the court in relation to these things, but she's defending the position of the court. Something created by the court, not created by Congress. Here we go. Let's continue. And the majority cannot destroy one doctrine of judicial humility without making a laughingstock of a second. If opinions had titles, a good candidate for today's would be Hubris Squared. Stare decisis is, among other things, a way to remind judges that wisdom often lies in what prior judges have done. It is a break on the urge to convert every new judge's opinion into a new legal rule or regime. Right. Chevron is entrenched precedent entitled to the protection of stare decisis, even as the majority acknowledges. In fact, Chevron is entitled to a supercharged version of that doctrine because Congress would have could always overrule the decision, and that sounds very strange to me. Did she just say that Congress could overrule a decision of the Supreme Court? I mean, I'm highlighting it for you. Can you verify that's what she said? I mean, hey, look, don't take my word for it. Just look at what she said. In fact, Chevron is entitled to the supercharged version of that doctrine. And, you know, she's quoting Roe versus her opinion in Roe versus Wade, or the Dobbs, you know, was she was defending Roe from being overturned. She said that, you know, Roe deserved stare decisis just like Chevron does now. Because Congress could always overrule the decision. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so Congress has the power to overrule the Supreme Court on this, she's saying. All right, okay, let's continue. And because so many governmental and private actors have relied on it for so long. Because that is so, the majority needs a particularly special justification for its action. But the majority has nothing that would qualify. It barely tries to advance the usual factors this court invokes for overruling precedent. Its justification comes down in the end to this: courts must have more to say over regulation. Over the provision of health care, the protection of the environment, the safety of consumer products, the efficacy of transportation systems, and so on. A long-standing precedent at the crux of administrative governance thus falls victim to bald assertion of judicial authority. The majority disdains restraint and grasps for power. Okay, well, there you have it. There's the first part of Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo Kagan dissenting, joined by the other Democrats on the Supreme Court. We're going to get to Roman numeral one next time, and we're going to cruise through this dissent. We're going to go as fast as the material lends itself to going. Have we abandoned Scalia's dissent in Morrison versus Olson? No, we have not. And you'll notice that these go together very nicely, these two themes of Morrison versus Olson, the dissent, and then Loper Bright and the Chevron doctrine. Now, this all has to do with who's in charge of the executive branch of government. And the Constitution does have something to say about it. I don't know if you've seen me talk about Section 1 of Article 2, but this is the section that creates the president. It says the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. He, it's a singular. Consider the following analogy, as I wrote about on Substack today. A mainline Protestant church hires a biblically literate pastor, preacher, who fully intends taking the Bible to be authoritative, fully intends, hold on. This pastor, preacher, biblically literate, fully intends to bring the ministry of the church in line with biblical teaching and biblical authority. The theory being that the church is under biblical authority, scriptural authority. Okay. And imagine that some people in the church completely freak out and they say, it's a crisis. This is a crisis. Now, if you're of the view that the scripture in the Bible is the authority for ministry, then you would interpret the crisis as something that occurred before this preacher pastor was hired and that caused the mess that he now needs to clean up. It's the crisis would not be the hiring of this guy. That would be the solution to the crisis, or at least part of the solution. So, by analogy, a president that is hired because he read the Constitution on executive power and, what do you know, paid attention to and took the text of the Constitution to be authoritative in his theory about executive power under the Constitution. What a concept. And says, we need to clean this up because we've been ignoring this for a long time and it's a disaster. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. It is Tuesday, 18 March, 2020, years after Jesus. We'll see you next time.